Goodbye to the Fruits by John Barth. I agreed to die, stipulating only that I first be permitted to re-behold and bid goodbye to those of Earth's fruits that I had particularly enjoyed in my not extraordinary lifetime. What I had in mind, in the first instance, were such literal items as apples and oranges. Of the former, the variety called Golden Delicious had long been my favourite, especially those with a blush of rose on their fetchingly speckled yellow-green cheeks. Of the latter, but then there's no comparing apples to oranges, is there? Nor either of those to black plums. Truly incomparable, in my opinion, on the rare occasions when one found them neither under nor overripe. Goodbye to all three, alas. Likewise to bananas, whether sliced transversely atop unsweetened breakfast cereal, split longitudinally under scoops of frozen yogurt, barbecued in foil with chutney, or blended with lime juice, rum, and Cointreau into frozen daiquiris on a Chesapeake August late afternoon. Lime juice. Yes, farewell, dear zesty limes, squeezed into gins and tonics before stirring and over bluefish fillets before grilling. Adieu, too, to your citric cousins, the lemons, particularly those with the thinnest of skins, always the most juiceful, without whose piquance one could scarcely imagine fresh seafood, and whose literal zest was such a challenge for us kitchen co-pilots to scrape a half tablespoon's worth of without getting the bitter white underpeel as well. Adieu to black seedless grapes for eating with ripe cheeses, and to all the nobler stocks for vinting, except maybe Chardonnay. I happened not to share the American yuppie thirst for Chardonnay. Too overflavoured for my palate. Give me a plain, light, dry Chablis at any time instead of Chardonnay, and if you can find so simple a thing on our restaurant wine list these days. And whatever happened to soft, dry reds that don't cost an arm and a leg on the one hand, so to speak, or on the other, taste of iron and acetic acid? But this was no time for such cavils. Goodbye, blessed fruit of the vineyard. A dinner without which was like a day without etc. Goodbye to the fruits of those other vines, in particular the strawberry. If berries are properly to be called fruits, the tomato, and the only melon I would really miss, our local cantaloupe. Goodbye to that most sexual of fruits, the guava, to peaches, plantains, fried, pomegranates and papayas, to the fruits of pineapple field and coconut tree, if nuts are fruits and coconuts not, and of whatever it is that kiwis grow on. As for pears, I had always thought them better canned than fresh, as Hemingway's Nick Adams says of apricots in the story Big Two-Hearted River. But I couldn't see kissing a can goodbye, so I guessed that just about did the fruits. I myself preferred my apricots sun-dried rather than either fresh or canned. The literal fruits, I mean, of course. But surely it wouldn't overstretch either the term or anyone's patience to include in my terminal bye-byes such other edibles of the vegetable kingdom as parboiled fresh asparagus served cold with sesame oil and soy sauce, sorely to be missed in the afterlife if there were one and food consumption were a feature of it. Likewise, tossed salads of most sorts, except fruit salads, which for some reason never appealed to me, and to whose principal ingredients I have severally made my goodbyes already, QED. Also, pasta. If pasta's a vegetable. I had long been a fan of pasta in all its protean forms, including the non-Italian, such as Japanese cellophane noodles, which I presumed to be some sort of pasta despite their transparency, and German Spätzle. Moreover, If I remained untouched by the popularity of Chardonnay among my countrymen, I was a charter member of the Yankee Pesto Lovers Association. Adio, then, pasta con pesto. Faithful to my homely origins, however, I insisted on equal farewell time for the simple potato, whether boiled, baked, mashed, or French fried, with the unhealthy but delicious salt and vinegar, no ketchup, please, and the inelegant Ford Hook Lima bean, which, out of some childhood impulse to diversify my mother's simple cookery, I used to stir into my creamed chipped beef, or mix with my mashed white potatoes and pan gravy on the plate beside my southern fried chicken. Culinary items to which I had bidden goodbye decades ago, and so needn't clutter my present agenda with. Friendly and nutritious veggies, hail! Although I never quite achieved vegetarianism, and to this ultimate or all but ultimate hour continued to regard you essentially as the garnish to my dinner entree, you are a garnish that I would miss almost as much as table wine if missing things were posthumously possible. Goodbye, Garnie. Moving nearer to the centre of life's plate, as it were, with only a bit more stretching of the parameters, if parameters can be said to be stretched at all by centripetal motion, might we not add, must we not add, to our hail and farewell lists of the fruits of the sea, succulent in all languages but to my ear, especially those in the Romance family. Fruit de mer, frutti de mare, frutas de mar, and however it goes in sensual Portuguese. I could reluctantly get by without red meat. Grilled lamb chops especially. It pained me to contemplate giving up, seasoned with salt, pepper, crushed garlic, and ground cumin. And only a tad less reluctantly without the flesh of light-fleshed fowl, in particular the breast meat of turkeys, chickens, and barbecued Cornish hens. But finfish and shellfish of all varieties had for so long been at the centre of my diet, it was scarcely an exaggeration to say that my flesh, by the time I tell of, was largely composed of theirs. If one had been permitted to slip in a request among one's farewells, mine would have been that my remains be somehow returned uncombusted to my home waters, there to be recycled to the fauna whereupon I had so thrived, and thence on out into the general marine food chain. Rockfish, bluefish, sea trout, shad, blue crabs, oysters, scallops, mussels, clams, billfish, tuna, and other steak fish, octopus and squid, in particular the stuffed baby Spanish variety called chiperones, sushi and sashimi of every sort, and last, because first among equals, the king of crustaceans, the New England lobster, Homarus americanus, whose spiny Caribbean cousin was, in my estimation, but an overrated poor relative, though undeniably handsome. Adieu to you, noble down east lobster, all too rare because so damned expensive treat. That shouldst be steamed not a minute longer than half the time, recommended by James Beard and most other seafood cookbook authors. 10 minutes tops for a less than 2-pounder, mark my parting words, or the animal has suffered and died in vain. A quick death, God help us all, declares the character Bilacqua in Samuel Beckett's story Dante and the Lobster, to which the story's narrator replies, in propria persona, it is not. But, as the true soul food is beauty, who could leave this vale of delights without farewelling at least a few representative examples of those flora and fauna that one eats only with one's eyes, and in some instances, one's ears and nose? I meant, e.g., the very nearly over-gorgeous fish and shellfish of saltwater aquarium and coral reef, Whether viewed first-hand or on public television nature shows and National Geographic photo spreads, the astonishing birds of tropical latitudes and the butterflies of even our temperate zone, particularly the monarchs hanging in migratory clusters from California eucalyptus between November and March, the unabashed sexuality of flowers, and the patient dignity of trees. Large trees especially, certain landscapes, seascapes, skyscapes, cityscapes, desert and marshscapes in particular, I supposed for myself, if I had been obliged, as perhaps I was, to choose only one of the above to pay final respects to, the vast tide marshes of my natal country, marshes which, while considerably less vast than they had been even in my childhood, remained still reasonably vast, as of this valediction, always assuming that one was permitted to valedict. Nursery of the Chesapeake, and, by semi-coincidence, of their present valedictorian, semi in that it might be presumed to have been unpredestined that I be born and raised in or near the marshlands of Maryland's lower eastern shore. But it was no coincidence that, I having been therein born and raised, those home marshes loomed so large in my imagination, if a marsh can be properly said to loom. For the sake of variety and euphony, I have been going to say home bogs just then, instead of home marshes. But it suddenly occurred to me for the first time, surprisingly enough at my age and stage, what the difference is between bog and marsh, particularly tide marsh. As between marsh and swamp, I confess, the geological distinction eludes me still, although their connotations surely differ. Marshes, I was saying goodbye, goodbye, goodbye to. Goodbye, still considerable and fecund wetlands, at once fragile and resilient, neither land nor sea, symbolic equally of death and of regeneration, your boundaries ever-changing, undefined, negotiable, your horizontality as ubiquitous as your horizon is horizontal, etc., etc., and with also eloquently sung in your East Anglican manifestation by the novelist Graham Swift in his novel Waterlands, not to mention by the novelist Charles Dickens in such of his novels as Bleak House, David Copperfield, and Great Expectations, that one would scarcely have presumed to do more than refer the attender of these farewells to those novelists' novels, pardon my syntax, were it not that, as between East Anglia and the eastern shore of Maryland, the differences are at least as noteworthy, even unto their fenlands, as are any similarities. To my dear, spooky, mud-flat, fragrant marshes, then, cross-fingered, fare thee well. But I couldn't leave the subject of marshes, hard enough to leave the marshes themselves, without a word of concern for the marsh Arabs. The maiden people, I mean, whose fortune it had been for 4,000 years to inhabit the marshes of the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in southern Iraq, and whose current misfortune it was to have been, for the past few hundred of those 4,000 years, at least nominally Shiite Muslims, who, self-reliant and wary of outsiders like most marsh-dwellers, resisted the despotic Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein, and were therefore, as I prepared to make these rhetorical farewells, being systematically exterminated by that regime, both directly, by means including poison gas, it was alleged, but not yet proved, which Saddam had ruthlessly employed against the Mardan's northern counterparts, the Kurds, and indirectly, via the dreadful expedient of drying up their marshes by diverting the inflow of those primordial civilization-cradling rivers, an ecological atrocity on a par with the Iraqis' firing of the Kuwaiti oil fields. Goodbye indeed, one feared and fears, to the oldest continuous culture on the planet, numerous of whose communities have lived generation after generation on floating islands of Spartina, continually replenishing them with fresh layers of reed on top as the bottom layers decompose and recycle. Goodbye, poor hapless marsh Arabs, about to be destroyed in an eye blink of time while still believing, after 4 millennia of harmlessly habitating your marshes, that somewhere in their labyrinthine fastness lies the Arabian Nights-like island of Hufaid, complete with enchanted palaces of gold and crystal, Edenic gardens, and the Sinbadish aspect of transforming into babbling lunatics any marshfarers who stumble upon it. May all destroyers of marshes serendipitously so stumble. Nothing quite like you feared, I suppose, in the solitudinous wetland of my home country. Only the odd goose-blind muskrat house, and, within living memory, moonshiner still. Though there is an uncanniness about even their low-lying, uninhabited islands, to which I truly now bade goodbye and better luck than the Mardans. No marsh, however, one might say, paraphrasing John Donne, is an island. Indeed, in nature's seamless web, if one might be permitted to mix metaphors so late in the day, no island is an island. When we lose the enchanted isle of Hufaid by losing the marshes that sustained the culture whose imaginations sustained that realm, we lose an item from the general cultural store, and thus, figuratively at least, lose a part of ourselves. Just as, literally, when we lose Poplar Island, say, in the Upper Chesapeake, to the less malign forces of natural erosion, as happened to be happening apace even as I bade these goodbyes, we increase the exposure of Tilghman Island, just behind Poplar, to those same forces, etc., if not ad infinitum, anyhow, to the end of the chapter. As Cervantes' Sancho Panza puts it from time to time in Don Quixote, the geological chapter of Chesapeake Bay, as we've known it since the last ice age, continually being reconfigured not only over millennia, but over the span of a single lifetime. Where now is Sharp's Island, e.g., which I well remember at the mouth of the great Choptank River in my boyhood? Whereto, I meant equally that island, that river, that bay, and that lifetime, I now bade goodbye. In the calm urgency of farewell, I hereabouts noticed I had inadvertently changed the thrust of this valediction by conflating, in the passage above, the callous despoliation of the natural environment by Saddam Hussein's Baathists, and stateside by the likes of real estate developers, clear-cutting timber folk, and toxic dumpers, in which last category our military-industrial complex stood out as a particularly egregious offender. Conflating these, I say, with such natural rearrangers of that environ as hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and such like forces, ranging from earth-destroying asteroidal impact on the scale's high end to the gentle continuous attrition on its low of the mildest rain shower, the softest breeze, mere cellular decay, the inexorable rub of time. Time, yes, there was the rub. Barely mortal, time enough to kiss Earth's fruits hello before we kiss them goodbye. And there I had so lost myself in the marshes, as it were, hoping perhaps to stumble upon my personal Hufaid, if I had not stumbled upon it already, see how I babble, that I'd not even gotten around yet to Earth's salt, so to speak, nor, for that matter, even to animals other than human, except en passant in their aspect as table meat. Fellow humans, I did not mean, yet, the nearest and dearest of those, they went without saying, although most assuredly not without saying goodbye to, if that unimaginable prospect could be imagined. No, I meant, in the first instance, which is to say the last in order of importance, those anonymous others, just enough of whom kept a restaurant, say, or a street, or town, or planet, from being unbearably lonely. Goodbye, insignificant others, if I might so put it without offence, understanding that I helped play that background role in your life narrative as you did in mine. Would that your numbers were not so burgeoning, by runaway population growth in some places, demographic shifts in others, as to threaten the biosphere in general, and countless particular environs, not excluding my beloved Chesapeake estuary system. Farewell next, to such only slightly less anonymous but considerably more significant others as, oh, trash collectors, for example. Never, at any of a lifetime's worth of urban, suburban, and rural addresses, had I had reason to complain of the efficiency of the collection of my trash, both recyclable and non, no small tribute from one whose profession was the written word. Same went, except for the odd and usually inconsequential glitch, for the several mail carriers and deliverers of daily and Sunday newspapers to my serial places of residence over the decades. What a quiet, civilized pleasure to step outdoors on a morning in any season, sometimes before first light, and to find one's refuse collected for disposal, one's morning newspaper snuggly folded in that way newspapers are folded for tossing into driveways or tucking into newspaper boxes, and moreover bagged in recyclable plastic if the weather even looked to be inclement. And then, somewhat or much later in the day, depending on where one's address happened to fall on one's post person's route, to find one's outgoing mail duly picked up and incoming mail delivered. I shall miss that, chaps and ladies, so approximately faithful to the motto of your service. Or rather, should miss it, if etc. Goodbye and thanks. And may neither rain nor snow nor sleet nor gloom of night, etc. How fortunate is it, Aldous Huxley somewhere remarks, that the world includes people pleased to devote their mortal span to the manufacture and sale of sausages, for example, so that those of us with no interest in that pursuit may nevertheless have our cake and eat it too, if you follow my meaning, and possess wherewithal to purchase what, after all, those folks don't give away for free. People, people, people. Builders of roadways, tunnels, and bridges, and of reasonably reliable vehicles to drive thereupon. Therethrough, thereover, designers and fabricators too of such spirit-lifting artifacts as great art, to be sure, but also, for example, of jet aircraft in flight. Particularly, to my eye, those now classic swept-winged, rear-engined jetliners viewed passing overhead. Likewise of most, but not all, sailing vessels under sail, of Krupp's coffee makers, of Swiss army knives in the middle range of complexity, of steel-shafted hammers with cushioned grips. In short, of all well-made things both functional and handsome, as agreeable to regard and to handle as to use. Supreme in this category of human constructions to be farewelled, so much so, to this fareweller, as to be virtually a category in itself, was that most supple, versatile, and ubiquitous of humanisms. Language. That tool that deconstructs and reconstructs its own constructions, that uses and builds its users and builds as they use. Build and build with it. Ta-ta, language! La la language, the very diction of verediction in this valley valedictory. Adieu, adio, adios, etc. und so weiter. I could no more bear to say goodbye to you than to say so to those nearest, dearest, in particular the nearest dearest, so to say thereof. I meant the without whom nothing for me to bid farewell, to whom must strain the sine qua non of language, even unto sine qua nonsense. impossible to do, unthinkable to leave undone, and yet the mere prospect did undo me. Back to the apples, back to the oranges, I'd say goodbye sooner to myself, I said, and soon enough would then say it to... But it went without saying that I had been assuming, not that I might say without going, so to say, but say before going, say goodbye to the fruits, etc. Permission granted, surely? No.